Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show podcast on the Cross Global Media Radio Network. Visit cgmradio.com/Bob to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform.
Welcome to part two in our series of the Israelis and Palestinians correcting the historical revision. And now we continue from where we left off. We are toward the beginning of the 20th century today. Even though the Middle East became the prize of the British Empire, England had neither the desire nor the ability to run that region of the world forever. For this reason, they began working to create a series of new states in which the Arabs, who had helped them defeat the Ottoman Empire, could administer their own affairs. Although the term Arabia was already a general description of a large part of this area, many of the Middle East countries we know of today did not officially become independent nations until the British occupation and subsequent withdrawal from this turbulent region of the world. While working to create new multiple states, Great Britain, with the cooperation of the League of Nations, an early prototype of the United Nations, decided they would also offer an opportunity for Jews all over the world to return to their homeland. This invitation was called the Balfour Declaration. Needless to say, grateful Jews responded with terrific enthusiasm. Indeed, many children of Abraham did migrate from Russia, Western Europe, and other corners of the globe where they had lived for some 2,000 years in ghettos at the mercy of pogroms or harsh policies of anti-Semitic governments. A homeland of their own had been a hopeful vision to the Jews for two millennia. The most familiar Jewish toast, common at Passover celebrations, said, "Next year in Jerusalem." But few thought they were reciting much more than a pipe dream. Now they could really, truly return to Jerusalem. Just imagine how this must have felt. The Jews were going to sojourn to a country of their own, and not just any country, the very land of their ancestors, a land where a remnant of Jews had remained since ancient times, living side by side with Muslims and Christians, who also had interests in Palestine and who viewed it as their holy land too. And you'll notice I just said the word Palestine, as I mentioned yesterday. I'm using the word right now only as a reference point. You understand, I don't believe this land should ever have been called Palestine, but we'll move on. For want of a better word, Palestine. Now, what exactly was offered to the Hebrew immigrants by the League of Nations? Everything we would today call Israel, everything we would today call Jordan, and most of what we would today call the occupied territories. When Jews arrived, many of them purchased land from Arab lords. In time, a terrain that had been little more than a desolate, flea-bitten combination of swamp and desert swiftly turned green with farmland and transplanted trees. The economy also boomed, transforming this area in such an amazing way that the term metamorphosis barely does justice. New jobs were created, resulting in an influx of Arabs from other regions who now saw Palestine as a land of opportunity and employment made possible by Jewish farmers and businessmen recently arrived from Europe. What was the proportion of Arab and Jew in Palestine prior to the Balfour Declaration? There were more Arabs than Jews in the land, resulting from Muslim expansion. But the truth is, there was really only a handful of each people group because, again, the swamp-like conditions limited the kind of life one could realistically enjoy in the Holy Land. The famous author Mark Twain wrote as much after his own personal visit. He was surprised how desolate the Holy Land was, how little was going on there, and how few people inhabited the area. I'm reading a section from Mark Twain's travel book, Innocents Abroad. He writes, "A desolate country whose soil is rich enough but is given over wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse, a desolation. We never saw a human being on the whole route. Hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive tree and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country." All of this changed when the League of Nations invited Jews to resettle their ancient home. Ironically, it was after Jewish business created a surplus of jobs that Arabs flooded into the territory en masse, creating a situation where the Arabs greatly outnumbered the Jews. True or false, the Arabs who lived in this area were never allowed to have their own separate Palestinian state. false, and it couldn't be more false. It's a false that goes off the chart, my friends. In paradoxical fashion, the British, after inviting the Jews to return, sold over 75% of Palestine to the Arabs, creating a new country called Transjordan. This is an extremely important and seldom taught fact. Please catch this. Please write this down. Some 75% of what had been offered to the Jews was sold behind their backs to the Arabs instead. Not only were the Arabs offered a separate Palestinian state long ago, but they have been living in one since the early part of the 20th century. It's called Jordan, a country three times the size of what remained for the Jews. Now, the Jews accepted this betrayal only because they had no choice. What else were they going to do? After all, a sliver of the promise was better than no land at all, but the Arab nations and Arabs living in Palestine didn't want the Jews to have even a sliver, and fresh controversy broke out over what to do with the remaining 25%. How was the term Palestinian used during the modern-day exodus of Jews into the Holy Land? Prior to 1948, the land had not yet been renamed Israel. Since the Roman nickname Palestine had been around for 2,000 years, people were used to the title, but this was not a designation adopted by the Arabs. As a matter of fact, Jewish settlers referred to themselves as Palestinians. What did Arabs living in Palestine call themselves? Hold on to your seats for the big surprise. They called themselves Arabs. There was no Palestinian identity in their mind. The idea of a Palestinian nationality for Arabs in the Holy Land didn't raise its head until the 1960s. It was a publicity ploy invented by the notorious thug and terrorist Yasser Arafat, who himself was not even from the Holy Land, but rather Egypt. We will discuss Arafat and his strategies later. For now, all that's important to understand is that under British dominion, the Jews were known as Palestinians and the Arabs in Palestine were known as Arabs. After World War II, we were never the same again globally. The United Nations was created in an attempt to prevent any similar future catastrophes. The aftermath of the Holocaust also generated worldwide sympathy for Jews, a sympathy that seldom existed before. However, mercy toward Jewish refugees wasn't entirely worldwide. It came primarily from a rebuilt Europe rising out of Hitler's ashes and from the United States. The Arab nations refused to even consider the idea of a Jewish state in Muslim lands. New Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia and Iraq were now part of the United Nations, but they were outnumbered. When the UN put pressure on Great Britain to fulfill its promise to the Jews, a country of their own, discussions broke forth over what to do with the remaining 25% of Palestine, which had not been turned into Jordan. The Arabs insisted they were entitled to the remainder of the land. The United Nations placated to them without entirely giving in. A vote was taken and it was decided that the remaining 25% of Palestine would be partitioned, creating both a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jews agreed to this proposal and decided to call their new home Israel, a proud title from long ago before their Roman conquerors had renamed the land. The Arabs gave no name to their side of the partition because they rejected the United Nations decision, promising in no uncertain terms that if the land was partitioned, every Arab country would unite, attack, crush, and destroy the new Israel before it even had a chance to take its first breath. Now, let me stop for a moment to point out some obvious ironies and dispel some popular myths. Myth one, Israel came into existence illegally. My friend, how can that be if they were granted their country by the United Nations? Look, I'm no lover of the UN. If you've been following my radio shows over the years, you know that. Today, I think it's an organization that should be shut down. It was a nice idea, but it no longer works. It's useless at the very least and often arrives at decisions which both defy logical thought and ethical consideration. However, to those who love the United Nations, to those who want to call America's war that we had against Iraq a number of years after 9/11 illegal because we invaded without UN approval, a disputed but often coined position, you cannot have it both ways. People from the left who object to wars like the war in Iraq also like to talk about Israel's illegal existence. Face it, if the UN is your barometer for for world legalities, then Israel came into existence legally. Myth two, the Arabs in Palestine were never afforded a state of their own. I hope you're catching on, my friends, because as a matter of fact, they were offered two states of their own. The first one they accepted, and once again, it has remained a state to this day, Jordan. The second state was the partition of the remaining 25% of the land. This state, the Arabs turned down. Why did they turn down a chance to have half of the area? Because they figured they were entitled to all of the area. And the decision of the United Nations, the same United Nations that Arab countries had joined and promised to abide by, meant nothing to them. Radio talk show host Dennis Prager once had a female journalism college student on his program. She had just written a pro-Palestinian article for the school paper. The young lady was Jewish herself. I have often mentioned on this show that Jews today tend to be their own worst enemies, and this sure was a case of it. Anyway, in the course of the interview, Prager mentioned that the Palestinians, so-called, had been offered a state of their own back in 1947. The undergrad journalist quickly retorted, "That's not true. They have never been offered a state of their own." Prager responded by expressing grief that a college journalism student would sincerely write an article so void of facts. It was a chilling conversation. I felt chills listening to it on the radio. Think about it. If her own journalism professors, who evidently had never corrected her article, were not teaching about what truly happened in 1947 under the auspices of the United Nations, it displays one of two things. Either an incredible ignorance, which should disqualify them from being college professors, or a dishonest agenda, which should also disqualify them from being college professors. This is the kind of historical revision being taught at our universities today. Israel is the horrible aggressor, victimizing the poor, innocent Palestinians. Not that there shouldn't be sympathy for a lot of the Arabs who lived in Palestine prior to the UN partition. There are always individuals who don't care about politics and simply want to live in peace. Although many of the Arabs in Palestine sided with neighbor Arab countries and attacked the Jews with thunderous enthusiasm, others were given no choice. They were essentially told by countries such as Egypt, "Join with us or get out of our path, because with or without your help, our soldiers are coming to crush Israel and we need to go through your neighborhoods to do so. Abandon your homes for now, but have no fear. It's only temporary. In no time at all, the war will be over and you can return to your homes. Indeed, you can expand your territory because all of the Jews will be gone." Make no mistake, my friends, the issue with the Arabs was not Israel's unwillingness to allow a separate Palestinian state. Israel had agreed to the partition. The Arabs had not. The aim of the Arab nations was actually much simpler: the total annihilation of Israel, men, women, and children. You don't believe me? You don't believe me? Examine a few tasty quotations from the Times. From the King of Saudi Arabia, 1947. "There are 50 million Arabs. What does it matter if we lose 10 million people to kill all of the Jews? The price is worth it." From the Secretary General of the Arab League, 1947. "This will be a war of extermination and momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres." Proud statement. From the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, 1947. "I declare a holy war, my Muslim brothers. Murder the Jews. Murder them all." He also said, and you're going to love this tasty little morsel, "Allah has bestowed upon us the rare privilege of finishing what Hitler began. Let the jihad begin. Murder the Jews, murder them all." And so, as you can see, and I hope a lot of people are waking up, the complete unconditional elimination of Israel was the only true intention of the warring Arab nations. The very notion that they wanted a separate state for Palestinian Arabs that would live peacefully side by side with Israel is a downright lie, a spun fairy tale for the masses. Unfortunately, too many well-intentioned people have subscribed to this hogwash. But the war didn't go quite as the Arabs had planned. Against miraculous odds, Israel actually won the war, and the Arabs from Palestine who had joined the armies against Israel now found themselves without a home. We will make that the subject of tomorrow's program.
Bob Siegel Show podcast is a production of Bob Siegel and Cross Global Media. Visit us online and subscribe to the show at cgmradio.com/Bob.